I'm Glynis Board, and this is West Virginia Morning. We continue to hear from and about the youth in our region this morning, as we have and will all week. This morning, we hear the perspective of a young farmer.
So my grandmother, who was a professor of nursing at WVU, stitched every single ewe back together. We didn't lose a single ewe, and they all lambed.
More on the perils and perks of sheep farming, and more in just a bit. This is West Virginia Morning. A year-long debate over four provisional ballots in Harper's Ferry has been decided on by the West Virginia Supreme Court of Appeals. Liz McCormick has more.
The West Virginia Supreme Court voted unanimously this week for the Harper's Ferry Town Council to count four provisional ballots from last June's municipal election. The council had thrown out those ballots over typographical errors. The election was contested by two council candidates, Nancy Singleton Case and Deborah McGee. The Harper's Ferry Town Council consists of the mayor, recorder, and five members of council, all of which are elected to two-year terms. In a news release, Secretary of State Mac Warner says he's pleased the Supreme Court upheld state code that says technical errors shall be disregarded and the votes would be required to be counted. In September, the current town council, two of whom could lose their seats depending on the four votes, issued a majority opinion rejecting the four provisional ballots. Attorney General Patrick Morrissey also stood by the Supreme Court's decision, saying technical errors should not be used to deny someone the right to vote. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
Details and a timeline of the contest can be found on Harper's Ferry's website. The union representing coal miners filed a petition in federal appeals court asking for increased protections for coal miners because of the coronavirus pandemic. Sydney Bowles has more.
The UMWA asked the court to force the Mine Safety and Health Administration, or MSHA, to issue an emergency standard to protect vulnerable coal miners from the infectious disease. MSHA has the authority to require coal operators to take specific action to protect miners, but so far it's declined to do so. MSHA has also declined to collect data on coal miners diagnosed with COVID-19. The court filing comes weeks after the UMWA first asked for such an emergency standard and received no response. The UMWA has asked for an expedited hearing within 30 days. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles.
A federal grant will advance construction of a portion of Corridor H in West Virginia. Brittany Patterson has details.
Governor Jim Justice and U.S. Senator Shelley Moore Capito announced the $12 million in funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation this week. It will help pay for a section of U.S. Route 48 in Tucker County. Justice approved nearly $176 million for the project last year. It is the second of five phases of work on the four-lane highway from Kearns to Parsons. The work includes designing, grading, and draining about 4 miles from the U.S. Route 219 connector to the State Route 72 interchange. Corridor H is among the last uncompleted sections of the Appalachian Highway System, proposed more than 50 years ago in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. The highway is intended to run 130 miles from Interstate 79 at Weston to the Virginia border. Proponents say it would open the rural region to economic development. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
This morning, we continue an occasional series brought to us by students and storytellers in the Northern Panhandle. Ohio County Public School kids there teamed up with an outfit of urban farmers with the nonprofit Grow Ohio Valley. Jen Jensen brought local sheep farmers in to speak with students. Together, they brought us this story.
So that's what wool feels like when it's still in the animal. I would have brought you a sheep, but...
We're here with Drew Manko, sixth-generation farm manager for the Ross Farm.
Maybe... You guys can come up the farm.
Their specialty rare breed sheep produced in wool and lamb.
Can we? Me, please?
Please? Before I have to go?
Drew's mother, Amy Ross Manko, says the family immigrated across an ocean some 300 years ago.
Okay, so we came to America late 1600s, early 1700s, depending on which branch of the family you're talking about, from Scotland and Wales. And settled in New Jersey and then came over the mountains eventually and got to southwestern Pennsylvania about 1730. Of course, it's still Virginia at that point. And our five times great-grandfather's house was used as the county courthouse in our area.
Amy says the farm is all home to 11 breeds of heritage sheep, which are breeds that come from and have adapted to specific challenging geographic regions.
While steeped in personal and historic farming traditions, Amy explains modern farm managers like her son Drew are part of a movement of innovative farm techniques that both lean into the future and hearken to past practices.
So when I call my son innovative, it's because he's not sitting back saying, well, we just got to ship him to the auction because that's what Pap did. No. He's going out and seeking clients. He's processing himself. He's got a USDA processing number. He's providing the community with healthy, humanely raised, sustainable food.
Cool. But what kids really want to know?
What's the scariest thing to happen on the farm, and what was going through your mind?
I was chased down by a steer one time, and I jumped a gate just in time for him not to get me with his horns. We were loading him up to go to the processor, and he decided that maybe he didn't want to go.
Whoa. Sounds like a potential gore fest. Speaking of gore, Drew shared what turns out to be an amazing story about how his grandmother saved their livestock from a dog attack.
66 ewes were ripped up by not even wild dogs, somebody's dogs that lived near the farm. So my grandmother, who was a professor of nursing at WVU, stitched every single ewe back together. We didn't lose a single ewe, and they all lambed shortly following that.
Drew went on to explain some of his sheep are butchered and their meat sold. Others are bred for their wool. He's also talked about what happens to the wool after sheep are sheared.
We send it out to a family-owned mill in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and they spin it into either yarn or roving and send it back to us. And then mom goes to 10 or 12 fiber festivals a year and sells them, as well as we have a shop on Main Street in Washington that we sell yarn from.
Drew's mom, Amy, is what's called a fiber artist. She travels all over these days with her wool.
I started a yarn company in 2012, and then people asked me questions, and I figured out I better learn how to spin and knit because I didn't know the answers.
The Ross Farm tend to more than sheep. Drew also spent time showing students a few photographs of the retired Disney horses they now own.
And that's John when he worked at Disney World. Yeah, these two worked at Disney too.
Wait, what?
Mm-hmm. They work for the mouse.
That's nuts.
Yeah, that's Gates again. He worked for Disney.
So all your animals are nice.
I try to. Yeah, they're friendly. If that's what you mean.
Animals are famous.
What they do for the mouse?
They pulled carriages.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
for carriage rides. John actually pulled the trolley on Main Street. If you ever been to the Magic Kingdom,
that's awesome. I've never been there, but that's so cool.
Right there, everybody.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for the young farmers who might just be starting out?
The main thing is don't give up. My generation has watched the turmoil that we've had in the '90s, early 2000s, where the prices are down, the inputs are up. They've watched their fathers and their grandfathers and their mothers and their grandmothers struggle and work a job or a second job as well as on the farm. And that's not something they want to do because they don't want to live like that. They don't want to struggle like they've watched their ancestors struggle. So the second they can get that, and it's that kind of, this is a small town, there's never going to be anything for me here mentality. So the second they're out of high school, they're gone. They're at a college, they're in a pipeline, they're doing something else. So don't give up. There's a lot of opportunities that the old timers either didn't see or didn't understand, like niche marketing, direct to consumer, stuff like that.
Drew also left students with some heavy thoughts about farming to ponder.
He says his least favorite part, the hardest part about being a farmer, is the risk he has to take.
Any morning I could wake up and the place could be on fire and we would lose it all.
Despite hearing about scary encounters with bulls and dire warnings about risks associated with farming, students came away with respect and longing to visit the Ross Farm. Many aren't far removed from a time when farming was a normal, critical way of life in their families. And many experts in the field say returning to small farm models, which are still prevalent in this region, is the future. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jen Jensen in Wheeling.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Ramon Gibbons in Wheeling.
That story is part of a youth storytelling initiative made possible through the Rural Arts Collaborative. It was recorded and produced out of a yurt in an outdoor classroom in the middle of an urban farm in downtown Wheeling. If you didn't catch all that, learn more online at wvpublic.org. And finally this morning, we want to share one of our first place stories from this year's West Virginia Public Broadcasting Writers Contest. This morning, we hear from Emily Woody of Hurricane, who won among fifth grade contestants. Here's Emily reading her story titled Cloudy Fields.
Once there was a cloud. He loved to travel the earth and admire its inhabitants. He had seen everything from waterfalls to mountains to breathtaking views from cliffs, and he was just waiting for something else to catch his eye. But the waterfall had been loud, and the cliffs and mountains were a bit scary when he looked down, as he had never floated that high before. He had been looking for something calm, peaceful, and secluded. Then one day, he finally found it. He had found himself hovering over the biggest field he had ever seen, and that field had thousands of flowers, as far as the eye could see. He knew he had to get a better look. As he floated down, he could see the field more clearly. It had all kinds of colorful flowers in all shapes and sizes. He stopped at a pretty purple flower with two buds, leaned down, and sniffed. It smelled of lavender and honey, but the wind of the field mixed in heather as well. He figured he could always come back and investigate, but he would have to go for now. He loved this field, but he always remembered where his favorite sightings were, so he could revisit them. And this was his favorite by far. But there were more things to be seen and places to go. As he was about to float up to the never-ending blue sky, he noticed the trees. There must have been hundreds surrounding the area, only allowing a trace of wind for him to float. He was stuck. There wasn't any wind. He couldn't float. What was he going to do now? The other clouds were too far away to hear them. They were up in the sky, having fun, and leaving him alone. He sat down and started waiting. He wasn't exactly sure what for, but he just waited. It felt like it had been years when he finally heard the sound of footsteps walking in the direction of the field. The big, wide, open land he knew as the flower field was now small and confining. He heard the steps louder and louder as they came closer. When they emerged from the forest, he saw a little girl, maybe 8 or 9 years old. He hovered over to her, and she looked at him with a curious face. Eventually, he figured out that she wasn't afraid of him at all, not even the least bit shocked by him or his situation. After a whole lot of explaining, the girl, Rena, seemed to understand why he couldn't leave. "Can't you just cut the trees down?" the cloud asked hysterically. "What? Me? No way. I'm far too small to do that," the girl exclaimed. The cloud knew he would be stuck for a while, so he started to sob. Of course, this meant rain for the flowers. "Hey, it's not all bad," she comforted him. "You could stay here and watch over the fields." The cloud would have sobbed harder, but the fact that he could stay here with this girl and the beautiful field stopped it all together. He took his time watching the fields each week. He took his time watering the fields each week, and the girl visited him every single day. One day, though, the girl didn't seem as happy and carefree. "Why?" When the cloud asked why, she had said, "I'm moving away tomorrow. I won't be able to see you anymore." With that, she planted a small seed in the ground. "Take care of the seed. It's to remember me by," she'd said. Then she left. He took care of that flower ever since and helped it grow. Rena Johnson moved back to her old town several years later, now 31. Her daughter, May, moved with her. When taking a walk through the woods, her daughter came across a flower field. Walking through it, she came to a flower that stood out from the bunch. It was the biggest, prettiest flower of all. It had a mist circled around it. Her friend had evaporated, but he had kept his promise to look after that small seed.
That was Emily Woody reading her first place story, Cloudy Fields. Emily won among fifth graders in this year's writers' contest. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. For West Virginia Morning, I'm your host, Glynis Board.